Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for joining in on our call to Tom Friedman today. It's great to have Tom back speaking for us, even though it's only by Zoom, but it's particularly good for our supporters outside of Sydney because they can join in, whereas if it were in person, they couldn't do it. So I'll introduce Tom Friedman very briefly. Tom L. Friedman is an internationally renowned author, reporter, and columnist with the New York Times. He's the recipient of 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 for international reporting from the Middle East, and the 3rd for his columns written about 9/11. He's the author of 7 books that are New York Times bestsellers, From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Longitudes and Attitudes, The World is Flat, How Flat and Hot, Flat and Crowded, That Used to Be Us, and Thank You for Being Late. And Tom's a very busy man. He's writing another book tomorrow, so we've got him for an hour. We're very grateful to have him. Of course, some of you will remember Tom Friedman gave our annual lecture some years ago, and after that he spoke for us at one of our public functions. So, Tom, as I said, we're very grateful, so off we go. So I'm going to talk to you briefly, well, for a bit of time, and then we'll go over to questions and discussion after that. So just give us a bit of a brief rundown on, I'll ask the specific question in a minute, on your current president and your former president. I know you've written about the latter, I think, in one of your most recent columns, which I read a day or so ago. Now, in Australia, President Biden is well known. There is a view, I think it's fair to say, that he's not quite as sharp as he once was when we look at the video clips from a little way back. And the question is that true? And if it is true, does it matter? Because as you know, administration of whether it's Democrats or Republican invariably extends beyond the personality of the president. So how is President Biden going?
Well, Gerard, first of all, I want to thank you and Anne for having me. I have nothing but fond memories of my presentations at the Sydney Institute. I actually can still see the first day I showed up at your door. I can see the sort of your little house there, and I forgot who introduced us, and I came to see you guys. That was many moons ago, many books ago. So great to be with you. I'm in my home in my office in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. You know, I haven't seen the president physically, so I can't, you know, and I'm not a doctor, I can't diagnose him. You know, Joe Biden, he's elderly. I don't think he's got, you know, dementia, but I think he's old and he's slower and he has senior moments and all of those things. But, you know, all in all, I think he's still, you know, functioning, you know, fairly well. And from what I've seen him at public events, he has senior moments, and I'm 68, I have senior moments. So. Our last president, whatever his age was completely nuts. So he was a sociopath. So the fact that we've just got an elderly, normal person is, I'm good with that.
So take us through the current administration. I mean, in any administration, there are some key players, but the administration works well apart from the president, doesn't it? I mean, who are the key players in the administration apart from the president?
Well, you know, Ron Klain, the chief of staff, hugely important. Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan, national security advisor. You know, General Austin, the Secretary of Defense. You know, they're the Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury. You know, these are the sort of the inner core, and then there's a layer below them, almost all of whom were actually in the Obama-Biden administration. So a lot of very, very familiar names who've worked together before. Bruce Reed, you know, doing domestic policy and the like. So you know, they've got a solid team.
So if you follow the media, not simply in Australia, but in Britain, to some extent, the United States, you get an impression that the Quad Group, reflective of the left of the Democratic Party, is becoming increasingly influential. Is that the case? And if it is the case, does it affect the administration?
Well, there's you've referred to them as the Quad. Actually, you're thinking of Australia, New Zealand, the UK, and the United States. I think you're not the Squad, which is how they.
I'm sorry.
They're Squad, and then the Mod Squad knows the Mod Squad. Yeah, so we've got the Squad and the Mod Squad, like it's all some kind of sitcom. Look, there is a wing of the Democratic Party. It was always a very progressive left wing, maybe somewhat bigger now, maybe somewhat lefter now. But the fact is, you know, I said this during the campaign, this being a pandemic, I can't really travel that much, but if I could have gone anywhere during the campaign, it would have actually been to South Carolina. Would have gone to a black church on a Sunday morning, but I've asked to go up to the choir, sit with the African-American ladies in the choir, and just ask them one question. Why did you lift up Joe Biden? Joe Biden was, his campaign was basically on its last legs until he showed up in South Carolina. And Jim Clyburn, the very influential African-American congressman from there, and basically the black community of South Carolina lifted Joe Biden up. They poured ice water on his head, slapped him around, said, Joe, get out there and back in the race. And he did that. And he was propelled from South Carolina right to the presidency. Now, why did they do that? Because they wanted a black president? No, actually, no. African-Americans, especially African-American women, tend to be actually quite conservative. It's because they thought Joe Biden, I believe, was the guy who could actually unify the country, bring it together. It wasn't because they had some super left agenda. It was not the left that brought Joe Biden to power. They were part of it, but it was certainly not the left. And it was the fact that a certain cluster of Democratic congressmen and women were able to win purple districts, that is, districts with a lot of conservative voters. That's why the Democrats now have a majority in the Senate and the House. So, the party has got a very strong left wing, and they're asserting themselves. That's their right. And right now we're in that kind of political fight between the left and the center of what each can give to the other. And that's what I've been calling for, because we have two challenges right now, Gerard, in this country. One is to pass the laws and develop the policies that will propel America into the 21st century in terms of both physical infrastructure and human infrastructure, so more people in more places can realize their full potential. That's one challenge we have. The other challenge we have is a challenge we've never had before. Our second party in a two-party system has gone nuts. It has become a political cult, and it puts the interests and demands of the cult leader, Donald Trump, ahead of the Constitution. I cannot tell you how worried I am about this, how dangerous it is. I've written about it a lot. I will continue to write about it. I just did CNN 15 minutes ago. We are standing on a false bottom here. We are standing on a false bottom. This place could come crashing down. 2024 could be our last truly legitimate election, if 2020 wasn't. I don't think you can exaggerate how dangerous this is. I don't know if you followed what just happened this week, but after Arizona Republicans demanded a recount of votes in Maricopa County, the largest county in Arizona, won by, it's highly urbanized, won by Biden, which tipped Arizona to Biden. They demanded a recount against the wishes of a lot of local officials. They brought in a pro-Trump election monitoring unit. They spent months and millions of dollars recounting every vote. After all was said and done, they found out that Joe Biden actually won by 368 more votes than he was given credit for. Not that Trump won. That evening, Donald Trump ordered the governor of Texas to audit Texas's results. This is partly to change the subject. In five Texas counties, all largely urbanized, that had Democratic majorities in a state that Trump won by almost 5 percentage points. And that Texas governor said, aye, aye, sir, and ordered an audit. We're talking about tin pot dictator stuff. I can assure you, Gerard, if the New York Times asked me tomorrow to do a live interview in a clown outfit standing on my head, I would actually tell the New York Times no. I'm actually not going to give an interview in a clown outfit standing on my head. I have actually some integrity. But the complete absence of spine, the invertebrate nature of our political, Republican political class today is absolutely astounding and breathtaking. These are people who seem so wedded to their $174,000 a year jobs and free parking at Reagan National Airport that they will not risk the tiniest thing to preserve and protect our Constitution. And that's why I did my column yesterday about Liz Cheney, the one amazing, well, there are two actually, her and Adam Kinzinger in Chicago, two Republicans out of this entire caucus of senators and congressmen have been ready to stand up to Trump on principle and to demand defense of the Constitution over the wishes of the cult leader. And of course, the cult leader is trying to drive both of them out of politics. So we're in code red here. I don't know what you think's going on here, but let me assure you, we are in code red. We are in danger of losing the crown jewels, our ability to legitimately transfer power in a free and fair election.
So coming back to code red, as you know, the election outcome was close, as it was when Trump prevailed over Hillary Clinton. In terms of the Electoral College, Hillary Clinton got more votes, but in terms of the Electoral College, it was very close on both occasions. This time, Joe Biden clearly got more votes than Donald Trump, but Donald Trump got a lot of votes. So you're talking about, of those Americans who voted, look, I don't know the figures, but something like what, of those Americans who voted, something like 45% voted Trump and 55% is a rough calculation. So if you're talking code red and you're suggesting, as you did in your very interesting column on Liz Cheney in the Times yesterday, I think it was, if you're suggesting that by 2024 we might be seeing the end of the American Republic, there's a lot of people out there who are pretty agitated, isn't it? How do you handle that?
Yeah, we are a deeply polarized country. And we're not only deeply polarized, we're almost perfectly equally polarized. So it makes it even more challenging. The necessary thing, but not sufficient, is that Donald Trump must be removed from American politics. And whether that happens by biology or by vote of the American people, I don't know. There's only one good thing about Donald Trump. God only made one of them. Oh, thank God, he only made one of them. Because you actually don't know and have never experienced in your life anyone that shameful. You just don't know anyone that is shameless. He's a man, he's completely without shame. He will lie, he will cheat and steal. And absolutely deny it. He will. You just have never experienced anyone like him. I actually know Trump. And so the question is, when he is gone from the scene, and one day he will be, you know, will the Republican Party come back and revert to some kind of norm? And I really don't know. Look, I have a broader view of what's going on in politics globally, and America is not immune from it at all. Is that I believe that all the major political parties in the industrial world are blowing up. Tories blew up, they became a Brexit party. This was a pro-business, sort of global, somewhat pro-European party. Labor became Marxist. Liberals in the UK just disappeared. Republicans became a Trump cult. France is the only country in the world that has a leader without a party and an opposition without a leader. I have no clue who governs Italy today, but I don't think they're called Christian Democrats. I think Italy and Ukraine both have former clowns as prime ministers. And so I think the Democrats too are kind of coming unstuck. And I think there is a reason for this. And I don't know enough about Australian politics. Yours is still holding, but look, the British, sorry, the German basically coalition post-war coalition just came unglued. And I think the reason has to do with all these parties were really born of the Industrial Revolution. And they were born of an age of binary politics, left-right. And when the Industrial Revolution met capitalism, it was an incredible release of energy and incredibly destabilizing. And it took us about 100 years to figure out how to stabilize it. And we all eventually settled on something called the welfare state. And there was a Chinese version, Australian version, a Russian version, Eastern European version, Western European version, and American New Deal version. And the welfare state was a set of walls, ceilings, and floors. And politics was a left-right debate about those walls, ceilings, and floors. The left said, let's have high walls. The right said, let's have low walls, not a lot of protection or open to immigration. The left said, let's have a thick floor, safety nets. Right said, thin floor. Left said, let's have a tight ceiling on incomes and on the pace of change. Right said, no ceiling. And left-right politics for 100 years was really about those walls, ceilings, and floors. Well, I believe what's happened in the last decade or so is that we've moved on from the Industrial Revolution. We're in a new era, or in what I call a new Promethean era. And it basically blew away the ceiling, blew down the walls, and crashed through the floor. And all these parties are disoriented. So some, to stay in power, have fallen back on tribalism, to hold their adherence through more tribal identities. Others are trying to navigate new coalitions to govern in this new world. I think that's the transition we're in. You're in it in Australia, we're in it in America. And it's very challenging. And then when you overlay on that a political psychopath like Trump, it becomes even more challenging. But that's kind of how I see where we are.
That's a rather depressing analysis of Western society.
I can ruin any dinner party, and I do weddings and bar mitzvahs. So just give me a call.
Unfortunately, it's sort of breakfast time here, and I think we'll hang around. So can I ask you to look beyond the United States? Because in a sense, from a quite different perspective, somebody might be saying what you're saying about the deauthorization of the United States could well be the leadership in China. So just reflect a while for us on the US China relationship, because it seems to me that, I mean, you're very, very critical, apart from Liz Cheney and one or two others, you're very critical of the Republicans. But what, and you mentioned that the United States is a very, very deeply divided society, which I think most of us would agree with. But what does seem to unite the Republicans and the Democrats, and to some extent, Trump and Biden, is a common attitude to the effect of an emerging China on the United States. So how does that, is that the one uniting factor in contemporary American society?
Well, this is where I think we need to put it in context. I would say this, that 1979 to 2019 were an epic in US-China relations. They were an epic. And it was the epic, I would call the epic of unconscious integration. By that, I mean, you could wake up as an American business and say, I want to have a factory in Tianjin, and you can have a factory in Tianjin. I want to have a supply chain from Dalian, you could have a supply chain from Dalian. I want my kid to study at Fudan University for a semester, your kid could study at Fudan. I want to visit China as a tourist. I want to hire a young Chinese to work for me. As a Chinese, you could say, I want my company listed on the NASDAQ. I want to buy an American company. I want to have an American partner. For 40 years, there was kind of this unconscious integration. And over those 40 years, China and America became the real one country, two systems. We were the real one country, two systems, not China and Hong Kong. And for 30 of those 40 years, basically, China sold us what I call shallow goods. Goods we wore on our back, shoes we wore on our feet, socks we wore on our ankles, solar panels we put on our roofs, shallow goods. They didn't go very deep. And we sold China deep goods. We sold them software, computers, and chips. Now, they had to buy our deep goods because they couldn't make them themselves. Well, low, about 7-8 years ago, China started to actually be able to make deep goods. That's what Huawei represents. And basically, when China just sold us shallow goods, We did not care whether China's government was authoritarian, libertarian, or vegetarian. It didn't matter to us at all because we were just buying their shallow goods. But when they want to sell us their deep goods, Huawei 5G that's going to go in my office, in my phone, in my sidewalk, then the difference in values between us really starts to matter. And that's what's happened to US-China relations. Now that they can sell us deep goods, suddenly the difference in values and absence of trust really matters. Now it does matter whether they're authoritarian, libertarian, or vegetarian. And then overlay on that the fact that China has a new leader who really has an ambition, I believe Xi Jinping, to be the greatest leader in modern Chinese history, superseding Mao or Deng or whoever, and who has actually decided to reassert the authority of the Communist Party. And he's created a situation where China today is so much more open than it was 40 years ago, but so much more closed than it was 6 years ago. So there's been this kind of reverse. Now you overlay those two things, that they want to sell us deep goods, but we don't trust to buy them. And at home, the CCP has been reasserting its influence and actually closing China more. And you have all the, and then you add a world of technology where everything is now dual use. Look, your toaster has a sensor in it and a chip. So I could actually listen in on your breakfast if I wanted to, while you're toasting a bagel, all right? So we live in a world where everything is dual use, and therefore a chip I sell you to go into a Nintendo game could actually end up in a military, PLA, some kind of missile or system. So when everything is dual use, but you have no dual trust, that's a real prescription for a very different US-China relation. Now, the problem is we still are very intertwined. You know, I was interviewing the head of Qualcomm the other day, their legal department's a good friend of mine, Don Rosenberg, and he was explaining to me Qualcomm's big chip company. They actually made the inside of your iPhone, Qualcomm, very important company. Qualcomm's relationship with Huawei. And he said, it's like this, Tom. Huawei is our customer, our supplier, our partner, our shared global standard setter, our competitor, and we're suing each other. It's a perfect description of Qualcomm's relationship with Huawei and America's relationship with China. We are competitors, we are cooperating, and we are in conflict. Welcome to the intertwined fused world. It's not the Soviet Union. The only thing we bought from the Soviet Union during the Cold War were caviar, vodka, and matryoshka dolls. That was it. That was all they had to sell us. And so they were just a third world country with nuclear weapons, and we could sort of deal with that. China is a whole different kettle of fish. And so managing this relationship from our side and from their side is extremely complicated.
Now, before we go, I just want to ask you one other question on this, and then we'll talk briefly about the Middle East, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. And people were given advice earlier about how to get into the discussion by exercising the hand function or giving us a wave if we can see you. In relation to China, as you were saying, you were talking about the United States' involvement with China in more recent years and looking at it historically. But from a perspective in, say, Australia and the Pacific region, the concern about China is not simply, as you know, United States or Australia, but I mean, our views about China would be reasonably similar to the views of South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam, probably India. So this is the projection of China's force in the region and influence in the region is an issue here, which goes beyond the troubled relationship between the United States and China under the Trump administration and now under the Biden administration. So from your own view of the Pacific, which you've written about quite a lot in your time, how do you see that relationship going vis-a-vis the United States?
So China, Australia.
Well, also those other nations in the region, China, Australia, but also South Korea, Vietnam, India. China seems to have a lot of arguments going at the one time.
Well, it's I think Xi Jinping has really overplayed his hand. I mean, you know, if there were Chinese, you know, a foreign affairs journal, you know, and I were the editor and I were free, the article I commissioned was, who lost the world? Like, whose idea was this? How is this going to work out for us? We've made the entire world align itself against us. And with Wolf Warrior diplomats who tell, you know, Australia, we're not going to buy any more of your beef or your wine, you know, because you want to know where a pandemic began. And so I think just slowly but surely, you know, the world is drifting both together away from and united against China in one way or another. Now, they're going to be a huge market, and that will remain a temptation that will give them enormous leverage. But, you know, the countries that I think will thrive in the 21st century are those that can attract immigration, can attract the most energetic and best minds in the world, and who can build alliances with people. And to me, China's going in exactly the opposite direction. And I just want to say, tell me how this is all going to work out for you guys. I'm not an anti-China person. I'm not a China hawk. I'm not a China dove. My view is build bridges where possible, draw red lines where necessary. But people like me, even with that sort of rather moderate, I think, centered view, we're looked at as sort of panda huggers in America these days. You know, only if you're breathing anti-China fire all the time, you know, are you in the right place. And I think that's very unhealthy too. You take a company like Intel. I mean, Intel earned, I think, 32% of its income selling chips to China. It takes that income, brings it back to America, and plows it into research, because Intel does not sell China its most advanced logic chips. They always sell them a generation and a half behind. So they take that money and plow it into their next generation of chips, which they sell in America and to our defense industry and not to China. And they keep doing that, you know, and keeping a generation and a half ahead. You tell them they can't sell to China. That's a huge hit. You know, where are they going to replace that market? So it's a very complicated business. We need to find ways to build high walls around small islands in China and low walls around the rest of the place, and not simply say, you know, we're not going to sell you anything. I think that would be a mistake. Also, you know, I really believe in, you know, building people a ladder to respectability. I suggested here, we let Huawei wire Idaho. Just tell Huawei, hey, state of Idaho, have at it, you know, just 5G everywhere. And we're gonna see how you do, see how it all works. 3 years, works okay. We're gonna let you do Oregon and Washington too. Works okay, we're gonna do the rest. I mean, at some point, I mean, I do have to ask this question about U.S.-China, Gerard. What exactly are we fighting about? It's not like China wants to occupy Chinatown in Los Angeles. It's not like we want to control Shanghai. It's not like they're more capitalist than we are, so it's not actually ideological. So I do scratch my head some days and ask, what, like with the Soviet Union, I understood what we were fighting about, you know? They wanted to export Marxist capitalism around the world, Marxist-Leninism around the world. That's not true with China. This is just the old story of a incumbent power and a rising power and all of that. But so I try to, in my own writing, keep a moderate view about it. I don't want to blow up the world. There are just too many ways and places we need China and benefit from the relationship. By the way, you know, you can't get, I was just listening to the business news in America this evening, and there's a paint shortage in America. I mean, there's a paint shortage, all kinds of supply shortages. I mean, because our supply chains are completely disrupted. I just think everyone should take a deep breath. I've suggested to people in the administration, I think Biden and Xi Jinping should have a monthly phone call. Every month. Xi, how you doing? Hey, why are you bugging this? Why do you keep cyber hacking American Express? I mean, what are you going to do with all those credit card numbers. I mean, do a giant Amazon buy or something. I mean, knock it off. You know, we kind of need to have that kind of daily dialogue with them, monthly dialogue. I just think that it would really be beneficial.
Tom, we're going to Okay, so we're going to move to questions and discussion. Then I'll ask one final question of Tom, and then we'll move on. I see Anne's there and Lindsay's there and Frank. So if you want to come in, just operate the hand function. I'm not quite sure where Tom said he was going, but...
I'm back. I'm just getting a water.
Oh, water.
Okay. My mouth was dry.
Not a gin and tonic, just a water. It's a bit disappointing. Okay, thanks, Tom. So just briefly, before we go to our questions, a reflection on the Middle East. It seems that one of the... I mean, you've been very critical of Trump's diplomacy across a whole range, including the TTP, Trans-Partnership, whatever it's called. In the Middle East, the United States, well, it wasn't just Trump, it was the Trump administration, of course, seemed to make some progress in making a contribution to improving the relationship between many of, or some of the Arab nations and Israel. How do you see that situation in the Biden administration, much the same or different?
Well, you know, I do believe the Abraham Accords were a great thing. It kind of fell into Trump's lap, but jumped on it, he and Kushner, very well. And I give them full credit for that. My hat's off to them. I think the more the Middle East looks like the European Union, the less it looks like the Syrian civil war, that's a good thing. So if the UAE and Bahrain and Sudan and Morocco want to open diplomatic and economic relations with Israel, that is only a good thing. Beyond that, though, honestly, Gerard, I mean, look, there's a lot of Middle East. There's Afghanistan, there's Iran-Iraq, there's Israel-Palestine, there's Arab-Arab. On the Israel-Palestine front, I don't see anything happening at all. I don't see this administration getting involved. I don't think that they think the parties are ready. I'm not sure whether they'll ever be ready, but there's no easy wins there. I think just encouraging Israelis and Palestinians to try to improve the economic conditions of their people, respectively. Beyond that, we've got Afghanistan. I supported the withdrawal from Afghanistan. We needed to be out. I'm glad we're out. Iraq has a very important election coming up. I've been watching that closely. I think the big question is, what is the future of the Iran, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal? I think Trump made a gigantic strategic error in partnership with Bibi Netanyahu in tearing up the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. I think it was a huge, huge mistake. And it's the fruit of that mistake is coming to harvest now, because Iran, once the deal was broken, has gone ahead and begun enriching uranium, a lot to 20%, some to 60%. And people believe it may be weeks away from having a sufficient amount of uranium for a bomb. Now, it doesn't have a warhead yet, and that would take a year, year and a half. But the whole purpose of the JCPOA was to have kind of a year that keep Iran a year away from a breakout capability. And it's not clear Iran wants to go back to the deal. And we're in the window right now of, will there be another deal or not? And if there isn't, then we're in the window of some really scary stuff, because then Israel might act. Israel might act in concert with us. We might have to act. So that's a much more dangerous story. We're kind of consumed right now internally in the United States. I mean, with all our problems, and Lord knows I'm as concerned as the next person. But I would say two big changes have happened out there. One is that the Iran deal may indeed be permanently unstuck, and that takes us into a whole new area. And I think the kind of basic understanding between the United States and China over Taiwan over the last 40 years, that, you know, we won't, you know, overly recognize Taiwan and you won't overly invade Taiwan, I think that too is coming unstuck. The world isn't waiting around for our domestic politics to sort itself out. And so I think those are two very big geopolitical worrisome issues out there.
Okay, so we've done our half-hour discussion. So we're coming to questions and discussion. We're going to finish no later, later than the top of the hour. There have got a lot of people in on this call. So as usual, if you just be brief with your comments. So we're going to go Anne, Lindsay, Frank, and Glenn. And there we go, Anne.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
I remember in this world of micro shadows and whatever that about a decade ago, speaking, I think, for the Sydney Institute, you were fairly confident that a country that censored the internet like China wouldn't run the world. How's your confidence now about that? And do you think in the end it'll be China that fails rather than conquers?
It's a very good question. You know, one of the problems one always has in these things, Anne, is who declared this year the end of history? You know what I mean? Like, so part of me says that let's just see how this plays out. It's going to look very different in the era of AI. China could be doing well by controlling the internet because it only controls certain parts of it, but doesn't control things that really crimp innovation. And it could look very different in the era of AI or not. So that's sort of one answer. My other answer to you, though, and it's a much more serious answer that applies to Australia and America and the West in general. So in 2007, China woke up. 2007 was a very important year. I talked about it in my last book. It's when Facebook, Twitter, the iPhone, the cloud, you know, GitHub, Hadoop, all of these amazing technologies emerged, Bitcoin. It was a pivotal year in world history. And in 2007, China woke up and said, so in my book, Lexis Neology, which is the first book I spoke at your institute about, I actually defined this place called cyberspace. I said, cyberspace is a realm where we're all connected, but no one's in charge. We're all connected, but no one's in charge. And China woke up in 2007 in this pivotal year and said, oh, no. There will be no place in China where we're all connected and no one's in charge. We are going to project our values into our cyberspace. So in China's cyberspace, on Sina Weibo, their Facebook, Twitter, you can't be anonymous. You have to be there as Ann Henderson or Tom Friedman, number one. Number two, a currency outside the control of the government called Bitcoin? Not a chance. Telegram, an encrypted app that we can't, you know, police? No way. So what did China do in 2007? It projected its values into cyberspace. Its Chinese communist values, be they what they were. What has the West fundamentally failed to do? We have not projected our democratic values into cyberspace. And what we do instead is just say, Mark, Cheryl, please, please do the right thing. Please, pretty please. If we talk nice about you, will you please do the right thing with Facebook? Pretty please. So one of the fundamental failures of Western democracies is that we have not projected our values into cyberspace. So it looks like no one's in charge, but actually no government is in charge. But when no government is in charge, it means the companies are in charge. And when the companies are in charge, they don't do things necessarily in the civic best interests of communities. They do what's in their profit interest. And so to me, your question really, Anne, falls in that bucket. You know what I mean? Will China benefit from the fact that it has no Marjorie Taylor Greene in the People's Congress who thinks that Jewish space lasers cause forest fires? Or if they do have someone like that, they're not allowed to be on the internet spreading that filth. We have the vaccination rate we have today, which is far below what it needs to be, because we have so many anti-vaxxers using social media to spread fundamental untruths. And so we haven't figured this out at all. And it could well be the death of us. You know, I am not on Facebook. I am not on Twitter. I mean, I use Twitter as a broadcast platform, but I don't look at Twitter. I don't get my news from Twitter. I've never looked at Facebook. I've never smoked a cigarette. And my plan is to die saying all three. I think they are signs of the apocalypse for the most part. And I think they're a net negative. I realize they have positive aspects, But Facebook would tell you we are net positive, and I would tell you Facebook is net negative, because I think collectively they're destroying our cognitive immunity. They're destroying our cognitive immunity, not to mention our COVID-19 immunity, our ability to discern truth from falsehood and fact from fiction. And you cannot maintain a modern democracy without cognitive immunity.
Lindsay.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Two short questions. You used the word integrity. Do you think the United States media is performing with integrity? And the second question, following on Anne, your topic when you spoke to us at the dinner many years ago was the world is flat. How would you describe the world these days?
Well, first of all, thank you for your question, Lindsay. Since the media encompasses everything from Breitbart and Fox News to, you know, the New York Times, I just don't think you can generalize. I think there's media that that believes that it's its responsibility wherever possible to correct errors and separate news from opinion. And that media, I put the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post and the New York Times and CBS and NBC. And I think they do better at that. They're not perfect at all, but they do an okay job, I believe. And sometimes far better than okay. I think you have another set of media in this country that are trucking falsehood, that are not fact-based at all. And I think they're a danger to our democracy. On your second question, what was the second question?
Just your topic all those years ago was the world is flat. Right. I just want to know whether you still think it's flat.
Yeah, I get this question a lot and on Zoom calls. And I have to chuckle a little bit, Lindsay, because I'm in Bethesda, Maryland. You're in Sydney. Are you in Sydney?
Yeah.
And we're talking to each other like we're next door, and people ask me, is the world flat? Oh, baby, it's flatter than ever. I mean, remember, I wrote that book in 2004, before Facebook, Twitter, the iPhone even were invented. The world is flatter than ever. In the sense that I defined flat, which is that we created a platform, technological platform, on which more people in more places could compete, connect, and collaborate on more things for less money with greater ease than ever before. In that sense, the world, baby, is flatter than ever. But it's a few other things now too, Lindsay. It's faster than ever. The pace of change is really fast. Because what's different from this Promethean moment, from the previous Promethean moment, i.e. the Industrial Revolution, was based on a single technology originally, a steam engine, and then the combustion engine, electrification, indoor plumbing. And all of these were additive. They grew in an additive way, okay? And you got a better steam engine and it was 10% better, and you got a better toilet, and you got more electricity, and you got a more interesting combustion engine. They were additive. What's happening in this Promethean moment is basically an ecosystem of chips, sensors, software, bandwidth, and AI. And they are not additive, they're multiplicative. That cycle just keeps going around, getting smarter, faster, richer, deeper than ever before. And so the world's getting really fast. It's getting really fused. So we're not just flat now. We're not just interconnected. We're not even just interdependent. We're fused in ways we've never been before. It's getting really deep, deep. You may have noticed we suddenly added the adjective deep to everything. There's no global lexicographer who ordered it, but suddenly people are saying deep fake, deep mind, deep research, deep medicine, deep everything. Why is that? Because technology we intuit is going so deep in us. It's going to places, oh, that's not just a fake. Lindsay, is that you? Or is that a deep fake? I don't even know anymore. That's deep, baby. In fact, it's entered our popular culture. The song that won the Oscars 2 years ago by Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper was called Shallow. But what was the main verse? I'm off the deep end, watch as I dive in. I'll never reach the ground, crash through the surface where they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow now. Oh, Lindsay, baby, we are far from the shallow now. Technology is going really deep. So we're getting fast, fused, deep, radically open, Now anybody can play. Anybody can be a broadcaster, paparazzi, TV star, film. Anybody can play. And the world's getting radically smart through AI, that basically machines can now outthink humans. So my next book is about how you govern a world that's fast, fused, deep, open, and smart. That's the governing challenge, I believe, of the 21st century.
Frank.
Yes, I was very interested in your comments about China. But
Frank,
I,
is that a tiger behind you?
Sorry?
Is that a real tiger behind you?
No, it's a leopard. It's just one of my cats that I just keep in the house. I was very interested in your comments about China, and but I didn't hear anything about the rapid and very strong buildup of military over more recent years and the effect that's having on people's perceptions.
Yeah, I think one, I think the broad answer to Frank is that there's no great power in history that's amassed the economic power that China has that wouldn't and didn't translate it into military power and a desire to shape the world in its own image. And I think that's what you see with China. And so its buildup is certainly concerning. And it's so concerning that we brought Australia into the 21st century nuclear submarine age as a counterbalance. And so, again, I kind of regret all this. Huge waste of resources for Australia, frankly. I wish it, wish you didn't have to spend your money on nuclear powered subs that won't be delivered for 10 years. There you have it. That's, that's human nature and geopolitics. And I just hope we can contain it so we don't waste all our money on that at a time when we're going to have to combat climate change and we're going to have to really deliver, for so many more people around the planet.
Glenn.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Tom. Speaking to you through my, yeah?
Yeah.
You can hear me, Tom? Hi.
Fine.
Yeah, Tom, speaking to you through my Lenovo laptop, which is manufactured in Wuhan.
Yeah, exactly.
Two questions, if I may, related. Have the American people abandoned the idea of US exceptionalism? And how do you see, can you extrapolate about how you see Taiwan playing out?
Yeah, it's really hard, Glenn, to speak about the American people. I mean, in a way I could 50 years ago growing up in Minnesota. We're a deeply polarized nation. And there are people who couldn't care less about American exceptionalism. And there are people like me, and maybe some of it's generational, who believe that we do have a mission in the world to be a beacon of freedom and democracy and free press and free markets. And so, I wish I could give you a better report card, but I can't. I've never been more worried about my country. The wheels can come off here. I just can't stress that to you enough. The wheels could really come off. The second question, I forget.
Taiwan's going to play out?
Yeah, I really don't know. Taiwan's adopted what they call kind of porcupine strategy. Strategically, having sort of enough anti-missile systems, enough tanks, enough rockets. What they want every morning is for China to look at Taiwan and say, not today. I don't think I want to wrestle that porcupine today. That's sort of what they've been doing. How long that will last, I really don't know, but that's been their approach. As just sort of one citizen, believe it would be really important for us to defend Taiwan, its independence, its democracy. It's a remarkable country.
Michael.
Thank you very much. In On Contradiction and Practice, Mao spoke about a 100-year strategy, and we seem to be 80 years into China's strategy. I'm just wondering to what extent China has lost its strategic discipline in trying to shape the world, because it certainly seems to have backfired. Thank you.
Yeah. That's a very good question, Michael. And I'm really asking myself the same thing, which is, I don't get this. I don't get how you think this is going to work out for you if every one of your neighbors is frightened of you. And you have no allies, only vassals. And even the Soviet, the Russians, you know, who have got this kind of alliance with them, I mean, they know that they are very much second-class citizens, and that China, you know, would have no problem devouring, you know, part of Siberia. So we're still early in this, but every day I pick up the news from China. You know, I just see something new every day that I know has just alienated somebody. And I just really wonder how that's going to work out to their advantage in the long term.
Jess? Jess?
Yep, sorry, just had to unmute there. Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to go back to your
comment. Are you at some sheep station? Where are you?
I'm in a place called Bathurst, 200 kilometres west of Sydney. Great. And a rainy day and the internet's not great, so hopefully you can hear me all right. Just going back to your comments on, you mentioned the phrase code red in terms of domestic politics and the potential rise again of Trump. My question is, Trump can't do comeback on his own. He needs, I would have thought, quite a few other supporters and stars to align in a fairly miraculous way. But to what extent do you see the far right and extremist groups and even the sort of less formal groups like, you know, QAnon type movements and others like the Proud Boys, etc. To what extent do you see them as a real risk of getting more and more organized and actually making it happen for Trump over there?
I don't really worry so much about that, Jess. I really think that, Trump has support of 78% of Republicans say the election was stolen. So let's say he has support of 85% of Republicans today. But there are 15% principled Republicans who don't support him anymore. In a very tight election, that's a lot. That can really mean a lot. If the Democrats can nominate someone who's got kind of the NBA league minimum ability to appeal to the center right, I don't think Trump is a lock. The problem is Biden is old, it's unlikely he would run again. And Kamala Harris has not demonstrated her ability to be the next president of the United States, to put it bluntly. And so there's a real worry, like what's gonna happen? Biden doesn't run, but she does insist on running because she can't win. And I just think there's a lot of uncertainty, which again gets back to where I started, which is why Democrats have got to preserve, do everything they can to make Biden's administration a success, to propel it forward, and give whoever succeeds him, you know, a decent running start.
Peter.
Sorry. Thank you very much, Gerard. Thomas, thanks for your presentation. Always read your articles in the Financial Review here, and I think your international perception is really interesting. But it does feel to me that you're missing some of the themes that are going on. And my question is, while you might describe Mr. Trump as abysmal and so forth, I think you can put those characteristics to any politician. But my question is, what about some of his policies? Are they going to survive, whether it's border security, whether it's taxation, whether it's deregulation? I mean, I thought they were really good policies. And I think a lot of people sort of separated them from the person. Are those policies popular still?
Some things are true even if Donald Trump believes them. So, I mean, you know, and there are things like, by the way, that I supported his China policy. My view is that Donald Trump was not the American president that Americans deserve, but he was the American president China deserved. And I supported him on China. I supported him on corporate taxes. I supported him on UAE, Israel. And on the border, I more or less supported him. I'm for a very high wall at the border, but with a very big gate. I'm for a high wall with a big gate. Secure the border. And then I believe if you want to come into America, you should have to ring the doorbell. just like if you want to come into my house. I'm pro-immigration, but I believe you've got to control the border. So there are things that he did that I think were right. I think there's things he did that were tragically wrong. JCPOA, canceling TPP. I supported him in taking on China, but not alone. I wanted him to do it with the world based on universal principles, not US tariffs. So you know, on these policy questions, you're absolutely right. These are things that, you know, were in the mainstream of Republican politics and even centrist politics, and we should look at them. But do not fool yourself, Peter. This is no ordinary politician. We have never had a president who claimed that a free and fair election that was certified by Republican vote counters, by Republican justices, and by a Supreme Court that he appointed, that it was a fraud. And when you do that, you tamper with the confidence.
It's very hard for me over here to
hang on, we've got to move. No, just hang on. No, we're getting right to the end and we've got to move on. Otherwise, everyone will have two comments. And so we're just getting to the end. Can I just go back to where you started, Tom? How's Liz Cheney going to go, the Republican Liz Cheney going to go in Wyoming?
Well, she's running against eight other people. It's like the Star Wars bar, I mean, crowd out there in Wyoming that she's running against. And in the Wyoming primary, because Wyoming is the most pro-Trump state in America. Think about that, what Liz Cheney is doing in the most pro-Trump state in America. So she's running against eight other people. It's also probably the most free gun state in America too. And so, but Democrats and independents can vote in the Republican primary. So it is possible that all you need is a plurality. She could get reelected with 25% of the vote. But Trump is running against her. He's endorsed her opponent. And we'll just have to see. If you haven't had a chance, watch. She did something quite remarkable. I mean, I know Liz for a long time, and we disagree on 90% of things. But what she is doing is remarkable, because she is risking her life, all the policies she stands for, and her job, to call this man out for his absolute abuse of our Constitution and our election process. But what she did today in the hearings with Milley, our chief of staff, oh, watch that news clip, because all these Republican congressmen were criticizing Milley for having called the Chinese and do all this stuff that was out of regular order. And she vociferously defended him and said, you had to do that job, General Milley, because all the people in this room didn't do their job. And that was no ordinary observation. So that lady has integrity. And unfortunately, she's in a party with way too many people who do not. And this has nothing to do with left-right politics and taxes or no taxes. This has to do with way too many people who have put their own interests and the interests of a corrupt man ahead of the Constitution.
It's nearly the top of the hour. So on behalf of Jacqueline Wilcox, our chair, and our board, and Anne, and the staff here, and all our members, many thanks for giving so generously of your time and giving us such an informed analysis. And we'd love to have you back sometime in the future. But for this morning here and for tonight there, many thanks indeed.
You owe me lunch in Sydney.
That's right.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.